Welcome to Food for Thought, an award-winning podcast that explores and celebrates what it means to live a life motivated and defined by unconditional compassion and optimal wellness. My name is Colleen Patrick-Goudreau. You can find me at colleenpatrickgoudreau.com, or if that's too annoying to spell, and I know it is because I have to spell it all the time, you can also find me at joyfulvegan.com. You can find me on social media, especially at Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. And of course, you can subscribe to Food for Thought on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, SoundCloud, and now Spotify. Thank you, as always, for sharing this podcast, for leaving ratings and reviews, and of course, for supporting it, which you can do at patreon.com/ColleenPatrickGoudreau, or you can go right to joyfulvegan.com and click on the donate button. Dispersed between and among our regular episodes of Food for Thought are special episodes in which I sit down with other animal advocates to talk about what it means to be a voice for those whose voices we need to hear and how to change the world for other animals. On today's episode, I am pleased to welcome Paul Shapiro, longtime animal advocate and author of his first book, Clean Meat. So welcome, everybody. I hope you're doing wonderfully well. You may recall I chatted with Paul on my Animology podcast about the semantics of meat, which is a fascinating conversation, if I do say so myself, about how our words about meat and dairy and eggs shape our thinking about what we eat and about how we treat the animals who were raised for meat, dairy, and eggs. It's a really interesting topic, and I encourage you to go listen to that on Animology podcast. But today, we're still talking about meat, but this time we're talking about clean meat. You know, as animal advocates, we're often challenged to answer all sorts of questions. And one question, a pretty spurious one, in my opinion, we get a lot, is what would we do if everyone stopped eating animals? How do you account for the fact that we'd be overrun by all the farmed animals if everyone stopped eating them? Now, aside from the fact that A, it's not going to happen overnight, B, the more we stop eating animals, the fewer animals that will be brought into the world, and many other things I want to say about that, and I actually do in a previous Food for Thought podcast episode I encourage you to listen to. But in short, my answer is we don't have to imagine some future where there is an overpopulation of these animals. We already have an overpopulation crisis now. The crisis isn't in the future. It's here now. We're already overrun with chickens and pigs and turkeys and cattle and goats and sheep. It's just that they're hidden in cages, in windowless buildings, on transport trucks, and in slaughterhouses. And the only reason the hypothetical scenario of billions of terrified cattle, pigs, chickens, turkeys, goats, and sheep running around the streets is as frightening as it is because there are billions of cattle, pigs, chickens, turkeys, rabbits, goats, and sheep confined at this very moment. That's scary enough. That's awful enough. The concern about them escaping wouldn't be a concern if we weren't imprisoning billions of them now. And there are many consequences of this actual overpopulation of farmed animals now. The crisis isn't in the future. The crisis is now. And I say all this because it needs to be said, but I also say it because I was really struck by the numbers that Yuval Noah Harari presents in his foreword of Clean Meat. I'm going to quote here. It says, "The world contains 40,000 lions and 1 billion domesticated pigs, 500,000 elephants and 1.5 billion domesticated cows, 50 million penguins and 50 billion chickens. In 2009, a census counted 1.6 billion wild birds in Europe, including all species together. That same year, the European meat and egg industry raised close to 7 billion birds, 7 billion chickens. And of course, all of this is because of one animal, Homo sapiens. I repeat, the issue is not that we'd be in a crisis in the future. The issue is that we're in a crisis now. And so for those of us who are vegan advocates, of course, one way to curtail this is to encourage and guide people to become vegan. Of course, that's one of the things I do. The problem is, I'm sad to say, global meat consumption is on the rise, especially in countries that are becoming more developed and who want to replicate the American decadence and gluttony we've come to know and model around the world, not one of our great legacies, I'm afraid. And so if meat consumption is outpacing new vegans in such a way that this planet is slowly collapsing under the weight of our strain on it, then what other alternatives are there? Well, of course, even if people don't become vegan, we do know that more and more people are consuming plant-based milks and meats. And the potential for the growth of these products in the marketplace is massive, especially as more and more companies invest in their future. You can listen to my recent episode called Buying In or Selling Out When Meat Corporations Purchase Vegan Companies. And of course, there's definitely hope in these plant-based products that taste fantastic and are decreasing in price while they're increasing in production and distribution. That's fantastic. There is, however, a perception that no matter how delicious these products are, they're still not, semantics aside, real meat, which is, or real milk or real eggs, which is why innovators, scientists, investors, humanitarians, and animal advocates have been exploring another possibility, one that was thought only to exist in science fiction, but which is now quite a reality. It's not becoming a reality, it is a reality, and that is to create meat and other animal products such as milks and eggs and silk and leather from cells grown outside the bodies of the animals, thus eliminating the need for traditional animal agriculture and introducing the rise of cellular agriculture, thus eliminating the cruelty and the environmental degradation inherent in bringing animals into this world and using them up only to kill them in the end. And that's the story Paul Shapiro tells in his compelling book, Clean Meat: How Growing Meat Without Animals Will Revolutionize Dinner and the World. I read the book from cover to cover and was riveted the entire time. And I'm not just saying that. I get to pick who comes on the podcast, and I've chosen Paul to talk about this book because it is such an interesting story, and I think it's a conversation we need to have. I was riveted the entire time, and I'm as far from a science nerd as you can get. This book is meant for lay folks like me and probably like many of you out there, and it is as much about the people behind the technology as it is about the technology itself. And there's really no one better to tell this story. Paul is a longtime animal advocate. For 13 years, he served as a spokesperson and vice president for the Humane Society of the United States. He's the founder of Compassion Over Killing. He's a TEDx speaker, and he's an inductee into the Animal Rights Hall of Fame. Clean Meat is his first book, and if his research, writing, and storytelling skills are any indication of his skills and gifts, this will not be his last book. I encourage everyone to pick up a copy. This topic, like so many in the vegan and animal protection community, raises many questions, and I really, really encourage you to read the book and listen to our conversation. Hopefully, we'll answer some questions for you and probably inspire some new questions, which is always a good thing. I genuinely, genuinely loved the book. I am so thrilled I got to read it. I can't wait for it to come out. I enjoyed every minute of it from the beginning to the end. I can't wait to have my own physical copy of the book. Of course, I read the manuscript, but it was incredible. I am really impressed, Paul. You are a really good writer. You're a really good storyteller. I loved so many analogies that you have in the book. We have a lot to talk about, but well done and congratulations. I'm predicting, no pressure, a bestseller.
Ha, no pressure at all. Well, thank you. I really am grateful that you took the time to read it, Colleen. And after an appearance on Food for Thought, how could it not be a bestseller?
I love it. One of the things I talk about in the intro before you joined me is I'm, of course, very struck by the numbers when we talk about, especially with Yuval Noah Harari's foreword when he talks about the number of lions we have in this world, 40,000 lions and 1 billion domesticated pigs, 500,000 elephants and 1.5 billion domesticated cows, 50 million penguins and 50 billion chickens. I mean, those numbers are just so striking. And of course, all of this is because of one animal, Homo sapiens. And the point is that this is not a crisis for the future. We're in a crisis now. And in many ways, you can look at science and technology making all of this possible. And your book, Clean Meat, is all about using technology to solve the most pressing problems, especially related to animal agriculture. So tell me what you think about science and technology and their role in the solution to all of this.
Yeah, I think you're hitting the nail on the head, Colleen. So technology is a tool, and like any tool, it can be used to make the world a better place or a worse place. So think about a knife. A knife can be used to stab somebody or to lovingly prepare a meal for somebody. At the same time, technology is what gave us factory farming, but technology may also end up being the solution to ending factory farming. And when you look at this new field of what's called cellular agriculture, that is growing real animal products from animal cells rather than from animal slaughter, you see the promise that technology has when applied to food to render the use of factory farms to produce our protein as totally obsolete.
And, you know, it's funny because we do romanticize everything that came before where we are now. We just have this penchant for romanticizing the past, you know, that I call that pasturbation.
And
but we do. We even think that, like, we act as if there was a time when everything was idyllic and we want to get back to that time. And even when we look at small scale, what we would call small scale agriculture or small farm narrative, back to the land, even when we talk about that, we forget that there were technologies that were new. And in those times, there were like human altering, disrupting, right, technologies, if you want to use today's lingo, the disruptors, that you know, agriculture itself was an innovation, and genetic selection, I mean, all of that was an innovation leading up to where we are today. So it's not like everything's been natural and nature-based and idyllic up until now, and now we're just relying on science and technology. Agriculture itself is based on science and technology.
Yeah, there's hardly anything natural about agriculture in the strictest sense. In fact, we've only been using it for about 10,000 years, whereas Homo sapiens have been around for about 250,000 years or so. And agriculture is basically the practice of trying to tame the land to produce for us what we want rather than what just naturally occurs. And when we think about the past often wasn't that awesome. Mm-hmm. Marie Gibbons, who is a clean meat researcher who I talk about in the book, had a really profound experience that's recounted in there, where she was an animal supporter, a vegan, and she really wanted to do right by animals, so she went to veterinary school. And she's out there treating free-range, grass-fed cattle, and there's this one cow who has an eye infection. And this is a small farm, so they can't afford to use anesthesia during this. And so they asked her to remove the cow's eye without putting her under. And, you know, this is on what should be a bucolic scene. And she just thought to herself, this is horrific. I couldn't believe it. And that led her through a process in which she left veterinary school and instead started studying cell biology. And now Marie Gibbons is the first person ever to grow and eat, no less, clean turkey nuggets, where she took a sesame seed-sized biopsy from a turkey and grew real turkey nuggets from those cells and cooked them up and ate them herself.
That's amazing. That's amazing. So yeah, one of my favorite terms that I learned from your book, and I want to know if kind of really where it came from, because I love the term cellular agriculture. So like we can make agriculture great again, but it's a very different kind of agriculture, cellular agriculture. So tell everyone what cellular agriculture is and why it's so exciting.
Sure. So cellular agriculture is the process of growing foods from cells rather than in the conventional way that we grow them. So right now, let's just take as an example in a cow. In the cow's muscle, just as in your and my muscle, there are what are called satellite cells. These are cells who their only career is to become muscle. If you get injured, if you get bruised or hit, then those cells are already in the meat. They go to work and they produce new muscle. And that's the type of muscle that people eat now. It's called skeletal muscle. That's what people eat now. Well, science has now enabled us to take a tiny biopsy that would include those satellite cells in them, isolate them, put them in a cultivator so that they think that they are in the animal's body still. So the cells believe they're still inside the animal's body, and feed them nutrients just as they would be fed by an animal eating, and produce real muscle. This isn't an alternative to meat. It is real, actual animal meat, just divorced from livestock raising. It enables us to produce real meat, obviously in a far more humane manner, but also with vastly fewer resources and fewer food safety problems than the current ways in which we're producing meat. That's one example of cellular agriculture. There are numerous others. There's also a field of what's called acellular agriculture, which is using food, using microorganisms that are comprised of cells to produce proteins that are acellular, that can replicate the foods that people eat now really identically, but without using a whole animal. So very briefly, we can, in the same way that if you add sugar to baker's yeast, you get CO2 to make bread rise, or if you add sugar to brewer's yeast, you get alcohol. Well, there are some designer yeasts that if you add sugar to them, they produce casein or whey or other proteins that are key to cow's milk. And then when you add water and some minerals and sugar to that, to those proteins, you have milk that is the same as cow's milk. It's not an alternative to milk. It really is the same milk with the same proteins in it, except you created that milk from the molecule up rather than breeding a cow into existence for it.
Yeah, so you, and when it comes to science, honestly, I'm a numbskull. It's not something that comes easily to me. And reading your book, everything was so clear. You use so many analogies that just make it really easy for me to wrap my brain around this. So would you say that it is similar to something like brewing beer?
Yes, it is like brewing beer. And I'm glad you say that, Colleen, because the book is about a scientific topic, but it's for lay people. It's not, you don't have to have some background in biology or tissue engineering or anything like that. It's designed to help people who want to understand what this new movement that is getting a lot of attention is really about. And yeah, it is like brewing beer. So if you think about how beer is currently made, like let's say you walk into a Sam Adams brewery, you're going to look and see what looks like a big factory with big vats that have yeast that has sugar or other nutrients being added to it, and it's producing beer. Well, we can do the same thing with certain cells to create not just cow's milk, like what we were just talking about, but egg whites, gelatin, even leather. And so, interestingly enough, the only one of these cellular agriculture companies that I talk about in the book that has actually commercialized its product is a company called Geltor. And this is a Bay Area company that is producing real gelatin and real collagen. So far, they're only selling into the cosmetics market, but they do intend to sell into the food market in the future. And if you think about gelatin, you know, this is just a product from animal skins or bones. And it's just, you know, these strands of collagen, basically. And we can create that. And so you can create real leather from that collagen. You can create real gelatin. It's truly amazing. I mean, it seems like science fiction, but it's already science fact.
Mm-hmm. And you talk about carneries, like breweries. You talk about carneries. Is that your? Did you coin that?
I don't remember. I would like to think that I did, but I suspect somebody more clever than I created it. It might have been Bruce Friedrich from the Good Food Institute, but I don't remember. I wish I could claim it, but I would be at risk of claiming something I didn't do.
No, it's great. I love it. Carneries is a really interesting way to think about it. And so just in terms of the language, because I know we talked about this on Animology, and of course, we talk about this all the time, that words matter, and the way something is framed really affects how people receive it or not. And so there's been a real journey here in terms of what to call this and how to talk about it. Can you talk a little bit about that journey and why we're now calling it clean meat and why it's clean, what the difference is?
Yeah, sure. Well, let's go in reverse. So like clean energy, this type of meat is clean meat because it's better for the planet. Fewer resources, fewer greenhouse gas emissions. Overall, just it's cleaner for the planet. But it's also just literally cleaner. So right now, people are warned to treat raw meat in their kitchens almost like toxic waste because it is riddled with feces. E. coli, Salmonella, Campylobacter, these are all intestinal pathogens that can sicken us if we don't cook the crap out of our meat, literally. I mean, you have to cook meat so much because you are cooking the crap out of it. And with clean meat, obviously, we're not growing intestines. We're just growing the muscle. So you don't have the risk of those type of intestinal pathogens. In fact, you're more likely to infect the meat with your own hands than the meat is to infect you. Mm-hmm. So it spoils at a much slower rate for that same reason. So it's cleaner both for the planet and it's cleaner literally. But now to your first question about why the term clean meat. I got to admit, I was a little bit of a skeptic at first when I heard it, but I really came around because the evidence shows very clearly that of all the terms that have been polled or surveyed, that clean meat performs the best. It's both factually true and it performs the best. So in the past, it used to be called things like in vitro meat, which of course, I mean, most people, when they think of in vitro, they're probably thinking about babies, first of all. Not the most appetizing thing when you're thinking about a sandwich you want to eat for lunch. Second, it was called sometimes even grosser, perhaps like test tube meat, which appeals to a very niche audience of people. And then cultured meat became the norm for many years because what the scientists creating it, they are culturing the cells. And so cultured meat came into vogue both because of the fact that they were culturing, but also because they thought it implied something that was, you know, more cultured, that was, you know, instead of barbaric past, a more cultured future. However, a lot of people, one, they didn't understand it. Two, when you hear cultured, you either think of yogurt or dairy products that have been cultured, which this is a very different type of culturing, or you're thinking about science. And not that many people are that psyched to hear about the application of science to their food, even though virtually every food we eat is the product of science. But it's just something that not that many people are that thrilled about. So clean meat, on the other hand, gets the conversation started in a way that none of the other terms do, because people automatically say, why is it clean meat? And then you can go on to explain what the benefits are. Whereas you don't want to talk about the process. Oh, it's cultured because they're culturing these cells. Well, you know, nobody cares about that. What they care about is what the benefits to them are. And those are the benefits, is that it's cleaner, again, for the planet and for the consumer.
I love that. You can talk about the benefits rather than talking about the process. And that's what's going to enable people to get excited about it and wrap their brains about it. So are we saying clean milk, clean eggs, clean leather? Like, what? How is that working?
Yeah, I am. And so are many others. There are, you know, every person in this field has to decide how they want to describe it. And for example, Modern Meadow is the primary leather manufacturer in this space. And they're really calling it biofabricated. And there's a big difference, though, between using terms like that for clothing rather than for food. A lot more people are willing to wear a novel material like Gore-Tex or carbon fiber than they are to eat a novel food. And so I think that's less important. But yes, clean has become the nomenclature for most of the entrepreneurs. The only ones who haven't really graduated to using clean yet are some of the academics who still, for the purposes of publication, are using cultured because it has a more science feel. And then there's also questions about how that translates in other cultures. So in Spain, clean meat or carne limpia actually does pretty well, whereas in the Netherlands, I'm told by Mark Post, who created the first of these clean hamburgers, he says that clean meat, when you translate it into Dutch, makes it seem more like meat that has been sanitized with Clorox.
Right.
So they might need a different term in the Netherlands. But for most of us now, it's really clean meat has become the norm.
Yeah, I've really come around to it as well.
I remember when the last time we talked about it, you were on the fence.
I was on the fence because it also had that sanitized feel to me. But I think it's very effective. I do also like slaughter-free.
Yes.
I know that's not going to be the nomenclature on packaging, etc., but I do like slaughter-free. And one of the things that was coming up for me when I was reading your book was, what's really fascinating is that as we have language like clean meat to differentiate the cellular agriculture, you know, the cellular agriculture meat, then it kind of forces us to have a term for that which is not clean. So having terms that really denotes how dirty and how you know, unsanitary and inhumane. I mean, just that, I think that will happen very naturally as well.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, when you use the term queen energy, there's an implication that other types of energy are unqueen or are dirty. And really amazingly, I was watching an interview with the CEO of Cargill recently, the agribusiness giant, and even he used the term queen meat, because they're an investor in this now. And even he used the term queen meat. This is one of the biggest meat producers on earth. And so, you know, we're getting somewhere when the CEO of Cargill is calling it queen meat.
Yeah, for sure. I think that that is really interesting. You guys are leading the way in helping people talk about it. One of the things I want to ask you about right away, because one of the things that a lot of animal advocates have heard about the process, I was so amazed at how quickly things are moving in this space. That was one thing that just struck me reading the book. And I love the way you tell the stories. This is not just about the processes. It's not just about the science at all. It's about all the players in this space. And you've really made them come to life. And I really understood everyone's role in all of this and was so impressed by it. So so there are real stories to be told around the people who were leading the way. And it goes back a long way. I was amazed at Winston Churchill's prediction. I had no idea. Was that something you knew about prior to researching this book? Tell everyone about the Winston Churchill prediction about clean meat, basically.
Yeah, it's really fascinating. So the future British Prime Minister in 1931 published this essay. It's called 50 Years Hence, and it's basically a series of predictions about what Churchill thinks the world will be like in the 1980s. And one of the predictions is that we would escape the absurdity of raising entire animals only to eat parts of them, when you could just grow those parts in a suitable medium unto themselves. Now, of course, Churchill was a few decades off in his prediction, but the race is on right now to create that reality. So Churchill's vision is now coming to fruition with the race between these companies to be the first to ever commercialize these cellular ag products. And it's pretty stunning to think about the fact that in the 1930s, Winston Churchill was thinking about this. I was aware of it just because it's a common theme in the world of cell ag. In fact, Seth Bannon, who is an investor, a venture capitalist, who invests in some of these companies like Memphis Meats, actually named his venture capital fund 50 years in a tip of the hat to Churchill's prediction.
So one of the things I want to make it clear that, you know, this is it's going to happen on some level. It's going to be an option. There's much to talk about. There's much to consider. There are many obstacles. You don't have to eat it if you don't want to. It's not necessarily for vegetarians and vegans or ethical vegetarians and vegans. All of that is true. So it's part of this larger conversation. We don't have to kind of take a position on it right now, one way or the other. We can have a conversation around it, but just in the spirit of enabling people to really understand what is at stake. I know some people have been concerned about the fact that cells had to be taken from a recently slaughtered animal. That's even seeming to change very quickly. So can you talk a little bit about the direction of how to actually get the cells to begin with to make the burgers and to make the clean meat?
Sure. So many of these companies are taking cells from pieces of meat from animals who were recently slaughtered, but there's no reason why they would need to do that. I mean, the cells are the same if you take a biopsy from a still living animal. And in fact, Hampton Creek has done just that. They took cells from a still living chicken and have been producing clean meat from those cells. And that chicken to this day is alive and well. At the same time, though, the acellular agriculture products like milk and egg whites and leather and gelatin don't require any initial animal starter cells whatsoever. There is a concern about some of the feed that the cells are given right now, because some, not all, but some of these companies have been using what has been the conventional feed for cells for the past 130 years since we started culturing cells, which is what's called fetal bovine serum. And fetal bovine serum is a pretty grisly product. It's basically blood that's taken from a calf who has not yet been born. And in effect, what that means is that some of these companies have been using it because it helps make sales grow very quickly. But by the time that these companies are commercializing their product, they all know that there is no possible way to continue using that serum because, one, there are ethical concerns, but two, it's just so expensive. It's so expensive to use it that there's no way to commercialize those products. And so the race is on between these companies to figure out ways to feed these cells with a totally animal-free diet. Memphis Meats, one of their researchers, Nick Genovese, has published a paper in Nature giving the recipe for how to create a synthetic serum so that you don't need to use animal serum. But other companies have their own methods, and Hampton Creek is screening hundreds of plants to find out what are the best nutrients for these cells, because basically you just want to give the cells something to eat that will make them divide very rapidly. That's the real deal. You just want big muscle growth very quickly. And they got to figure out what to do with that or what the best feed is, but they're working diligently on it, and there's no way that once it's commercialized it'll include fetal bovine serum. I do want to just underscore what you stated, though, Colleen, which is that clean meat and these other cell ag products, it's not necessarily for vegetarians and vegans. I don't think there's any ethical concern about eating them, but I also don't think that it's intended to displace plant-based foods from people's diets. The goal is to displace animal products from people's diets. So the idea behind clean meat is not to have something that's going to be awesome to eat at the Veg Fest. The idea is that it's going to be awesome to eat at KFC. Right. And that's the real goal here. So whether vegans eat it or not is really irrelevant. The goal is to have the mainstream meat eaters eating it.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, there are vegetarians and vegans who, just because after a time of not having that particular texture of flesh in your mouth, don't even like the, you know, wheat-based or grain-based chickens and porks, yeah. Right? Because it tastes too close to what, right, quote-unquote, the real thing. So that's absolutely fine. And actually, on that note, I want to just give a couple numbers here, because it just blows my mind, and I'm terrible at remembering these things, but I'm going to try to remember this. This is absolutely mind-blowing. One of the things you say is one sample from one cow could, in theory, produce 20,000 tons of meat, or more than 400,000 cows worth. You go on, enough to make about 175 million quarter pounders from one sample from one cow. That is absolutely remarkable.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty stunning to think about, because even if it requires you to use these initial animal starter cells, is it not worth it? Right. I mean, at what point do we think to ourselves, I mean, this is so clearly worth it. It saves so many animals. I mean, I'll give you an example. My first job that I ever had was working on this small organic vegetable farm in Maryland. And I had this very romantic vision of what agriculture was like. And I wanted to go see if I wanted to become an organic farmer. And you know, I was a young teenager. I think I was 15 years old at the time. I didn't really know what I was getting into, but I do remember being there, and I had been a vegan for a couple of years at this point, and one of my jobs was to fertilize the vegetables with fish meal. And I was thinking to myself, is it vegan to eat a tomato that has been fertilized with fish who were killed for this purpose? And, you know, you think that's really regrettable, but very few people are going to say, oh, tomatoes aren't vegan. No, you know, it's not like you're going to tell people, oh, be careful in the supermarket because tomatoes aren't vegan. Whereas this arguably has even less of a connection to an exploited animal. And the good that it could do compared to just eating those tomatoes is so vast. It's so monumental. It spares so many animals that I wouldn't worry that much about it. Instead, I would cheer on these companies and root for their success.
Well, you know, there are people who do say that those tomatoes aren't vegan, right? I mean, there are those people who say that.
Oh yeah, I'm sure there
no,
are.
No, but there will always be those people who will look at the lack of perfection and say, right, that they're not vegan. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. There's some people who, you know, I mean, there's a saying that I did not come up with where, you know, there's two types of vegans, those who want a vegan club and those who want a vegan world. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for those, I understand there's going to be differences of opinion about it. But again, you know, if those people don't want to eat tomatoes, more power to them.
Yeah.
But whether they eat clean meat or not, I just think that clean meat probably does even less harm than that practice does, is my main point.
Yeah, and perfection is the enemy of the good. I mean, I talked about this in the recent episode I did on the meat and dairy companies buying plant-based companies. And one of the things I did say was that even when we look at cosmetics companies who can call themselves cruelty-free today, a lot of the reasons they can call themselves cruelty-free is because a lot of the tests that have already been done were done on animals. And now because of the you know, laws that were passed, they can say, well, this is safe, but they can say it's safe because it was tested on animals at one point in that process.
Yeah. And going even further, I'm not going to name names because I don't want to unleash anybody on them, but there are phenomenal vegan meat companies that use ingredients that they can only use because they had been previously tested on animals. For example, beetroot fiber. It might sound like it's no big deal to use beetroot fiber, but for it to be declared generally recognized as safe by the FDA, it had to be tested on rats. So now all these vegan meat companies are using it, and I'm glad they are. It's a great ingredient for them to use. But there's this myth that, you know, well, they didn't test on animals, so therefore it doesn't matter. Therefore, it's no big deal. I'm glad they're using it, but I think we ought to have a little bit more of a charitable view of companies that are trying to do the right thing. And I'm a big supporter of Field Roast going to Maple Leaf. I think it's going to do great things for animals. And I think if you want to transition for these meat companies, like if you want to transition from animal slaughter to plant-based foods or clean meats, how is it going to happen if these companies aren't part of it? I mean, seriously, like, we really think that that our companies are just going to overtake them and put them out of business? It would be like saying, like, to when Kodak and Canon were fighting over supremacy in the camera market, then digital comes along. Did we really think that these small digital manufacturers were going to put Canon out of business? Canon now is the leading manufacturer of digital cameras, and because they saw the innovation, and now they're not really that into producing gelatin-based film anymore. But at the time, that was the thing to do. Well, what if these meat companies start investing and getting involved in the plant-based and the clean meat movement? You can see them becoming the biggest purveyors of these products, and therefore more people will have access to them, and it'll make vegan eating even easier and more convenient than it was before.
Yeah, that's a good segue to speaking of plant-based meats in terms of the availability, in terms of the resources that they're using. You have a great quote from Ethan Brown from Beyond Meat, who says that compared to beef from cattle, his burgers use 99% less land, 85% less water, and emit 89% fewer greenhouse gases than beef from cattle. Everyone needs to hear this. I mean, these are just huge amounts of resources going into, of course, cattle raised for quote unquote beef. So can you talk about when we're comparing plant-based meats to animal-based meats, can you talk about then the resources in both clean meat and plant-based? Because when I think about the resources, even just the agricultural products for plant-based meats, we're talking about, you know, proteins either coming from grains or from peas or, you know, whatever agricultural crop. Like, is that an issue in terms of scaling up these plant-based companies and these plant-based products? Is that even an issue versus clean meat, which would potentially use fewer resources? I don't know.
It's not clear that clean meat would use fewer resources than plant-based meat. Plants are really difficult to compete with when it comes to resource efficiency, especially lentils or peas and so on. So I suspect, and we don't know yet because, to be frank, clean meat is not yet commercialized and the technologies that are required to make it commercial have not yet been invented. So it's still unclear. I mean, clean meat is a reality, but it is not a commercial reality. Mm-hmm. So we'll see how efficient they can get it. But my own suspicion is that no, that plant-based meats will continue to be more resource efficient than clean meats, or at least most plant-based. I mean, who knows? Maybe there are some plants that are particularly resource intensive. But clean meat is a solution that we need in the quiver. So even if it turns out that plant-based meats are superior in every way, the fact is some people still want, as you called it, the so-called real thing. And that means having real animal meat. So I think of it in the following way. You have the problem of fossil fuels, which is a terrible, horrendous problem for humanity and the other species with whom we share this planet. we have a broad array of clean energies because we the problem is so bad, we don't want to say, oh, put it all into solar, put it all into wind, put it all into geothermal. We think that the problem is so bad, we need lots of alternatives and potential solutions. Well, if the problem of fossil fuels is that bad, the problem of factory farms is equally, if not even more bad. And you want lots of alternative solutions. You want a whole foods plant-based diet. You want plant-based meats. You want clean meats. Maybe there's something else that we don't even know about that could become an alternative as well. I just think that the scale of the problem is so horrible. The urgency of solving the problem is so severe that if there are potentially promising solutions, that we ought to be rooting for them, investing in them, and cheering them on. And so I don't see clean meat as necessarily like a competitor to plant-based meat or even superior to it, but I do see it as a necessary arrow in the quiver of fighting this problem of animal agribusiness.
Right. And it doesn't have to be either or. And it is the example of at least not trying this innovation and looking to this innovation. The example of, you know, Kodak, for instance, Kodak, you know, filed for bankruptcy. Kodak didn't look towards the future, didn't look to innovation. And it's not to say that the plant-based meat companies aren't also looking to innovation, because of course they are, and are doing really innovative things and really interesting things. And, you know, I agree with you. And of course, from those who have a much more idealistic point of view, we want to believe that, you know, we already do have an alternative to animal flesh right now. They're called plants, they're called vegetables, they're called grains, and then of course they're called
revolutionary.
I know, it's just, that's what's so, you know, and that's, of course, I'm always going to be a proponent for, well, all of these things, you know, like you said, your archery analogy of all of the everything in the quiver. But I'm that's why I'm excited about the plant-based companies really getting on the radar, because of the purchases from these larger companies, because there's still, it seems to me, so much to be done in the plant-based world, that meaning we can't quite yet write off that there won't be a continued growth in these products. And while we're working on the clean meat technologies, these companies are getting more. We were in Orland yesterday in California. I don't know if you know about Orland. Orland is this tiny little agricultural town that Farm Sanctuary resides in. And of course, over the years, Farm Sanctuary has developed a relationship with the shopkeepers and the veterinarians and just all of the people who are in Orland. And they have a restaurant there called Farwood. And we went to visit the animals. And then afterwards, we went to dinner at Farwood. And we knew they had a vegan menu, so we were already excited by that, just because they're obviously accommodating vegans. But we had no idea the Impossible Burger was on the menu at this little tiny restaurant in this little tiny town.
Very cool.
What was so lovely is our server was so enthusiastic about this burger, as if she didn't know quite we hadn't had it yet or that we were vegan. So she very enthusiastically was selling us this burger. And we said, yeah, we got it. We're on it. We're vegan and we love it. And we thanked her and said, are you this enthusiastic with your non-vegan clientele? Like, are people? And she goes, oh, absolutely. And they're ordering it. So I'm excited to see the future for the plant-based meats in non-vegan restaurants, because that really hasn't been the case. Even all these years that plant-based products have been in the supermarkets, they haven't been incorporated into restaurants. So I'm excited about that.
I'm really excited about it. I think that there is a huge room to grow. There's huge room to grow for plant-based meats. And you know, the best analogy is to look at the only category of plant-based alternatives that has really succeeded, which is milk. Mm-hmm. You know, milk right now, I mean, a decade ago, plant-based milks were about 1% of the fluid milk market in the United States. Today, they're at more than 10%, massive explosion in success. And because of that, the U.S. dairy herd has contracted, that there are now fewer dairy cows than there were before. And that is really stunning to think about how plant-based milks have done so well. Plant-based meats, on the other hand, are still at less than 1% of all of the meat that's sold in America, and certainly even less around the world. And so I think there's huge potential for growth there if the plant-based meat purveyors can follow the same path that the plant-based milk purveyors did, part of which included, for example, becoming part of the dairy industry. I mean, Silk, which was the big breakthrough product, was purchased by a big dairy company, and that's how they got the shelving and placement and marketing that led to Silk being such a massive company now. So I don't, you know, look, there are some companies in the plant-based meat world that want to remain independent. More power to them. I love their products. I want to eat them myself. But I think that there are other companies that want to become part of the meat industry so that they can have greater market penetration with these vegan products. And we shouldn't fault those companies for wanting to do that. In fact, we should celebrate it.
Yeah. Yeah. So when people are considering what to support and what to get behind, and as animal advocates, how to get involved, of course, there are so many different ways, A, because there are so many different ways we exploit and abuse animals, and B, because there are so many different angles to helping animals. You have some really interesting analogies in your book, and you make a rather bold statement when you talk about someone like Henry Berg, who I've talked about many times on this podcast episode, this podcast, and other animal welfare pioneers like Henry Berg, who founded organizations. They've gotten animal protection laws passed. They've changed the public thinking about animals, and of course, there's room for all of these areas. Even if clean meat succeeds and we wipe animal agriculture off the face of this earth, it doesn't mean we're wiping, you know, animal exploitation off the face of this earth. But you make a really bold statement drawing upon the work Berg did and others did in the 1800s to help horses. You say, in the end, what freed horses from labor in our streets and what saved New York City from literally drowning in horse poop wasn't humane sentiment nor environmental concerns. Just as kerosene helped save the whales, internal combustion engines helped replace horses as our primary means of transport. It was an inventor's imagination, not a social movement's moral argument, which rescued horses. That could be pretty hard for some advocates to swallow.
Yeah, it's hard for me to swallow personally, to be honest with you, because I've devoted over 2 decades of my life to animal advocacy. And one of the arguments of the book is that animal advocacy may not be the most efficient way to help animals. And that's not to say that animal advocacy isn't good. It's just questioning whether in certain cases it is optimal or the best thing. So I think the animal advocacy movement is doing a lot of good for animals, and I'm proud to be a part of it, and I'm proud of what so many of my colleagues have accomplished. But the facts are pretty stark. I mean, just to further that analogy about Henry Berg, you know, these folks were campaigning for all types of improvements for horses. They wanted resting days for them on the Sabbath. They wanted working hours so they couldn't be worked too long. They wanted mandatory watering stations. And then it turns out Henry Ford comes along and renders the use of horses as our laborers as totally obsolete. I mean, Henry Ford accomplished more for horses than Henry Berg ever dreamt of doing. It's not like Berg ever said, hey, let's not use horses. I mean, virtually nobody in the animal movement back then in the 19th century was suggesting that we shouldn't even use horses in the first place. You would have to be such a heretic. I mean, there were a couple individuals, but nobody in the established movement was really calling for that. But with a technological innovation that was so superior to horsepower, all of a sudden you had a way to free horses from laborers. Now, I agree with you. I mean, I don't think that clean meats are going to totally solve this whole problem. I mean, after all, we're a century after Henry Ford, and we still have horses in our city streets from time to time, or communities like the Amish who still use them as their primary mode of transportation. But I do think that clean meat has the potential to spare billions of animals from a lifetime of misery and violent slaughter in a way that perhaps nothing else right now has that potential.
Mm. Yeah, and one of the things, of course, that naysayers on the other side will say is, well, if, you know, we hear this all the time when we just talk about advocating for veganism, that, you know, that what about the people who are raising these animals? You know, they kind of make them out to be saints as if they're doing this from an altruistic, you know, philanthropic perspective. But, you know, they do say, what about the workers? What about the people raising them, the farmers, the ranchers, et cetera? And of course, you further that analogy when you're talking about horse and carriages. Of course, jobs were lost, but that's, you know, that's kind of part of what progress is. We're constantly reconciling progress and people.
Yeah, I mean, the next time you're Netflix binging, I doubt you're going to shed a tear for the Blockbuster employees who don't have those jobs anymore. I mean, the fact is that the economy changes. I mean, what happens when people stop smoking to the tobacco growers? Well, they're going to have to find something else to grow or find new work, because the economy is not static. It's dynamic. It's constantly changing. The same is so with this. Like, you're talking correctly about the horse-drawn carriages. Like, oh, what happened to all the buggy whip manufacturers? These family, you know, these families were had their whole lives for centuries. My father and his father and his father, all buggy whip manufacturers. Well, you know, you don't need buggy whips anymore. And the same is so here. I mean, we're still going to need farmers because the cells have to eat. We have to feed the cells something. But we probably need a lot less land and therefore less farming in order to produce these meats. And that's one of the big advantages of it, that it enables us to grow the same foods with vastly fewer resources needed. And so I think there's a type of creative destruction in the economy that occurs whenever there's a new technology that's more efficient or superior to old technologies. And certainly that's the case here.
Well, and it's not that we can't support that either. I mean, our governments need to do a much better job at training people for the future and training them in technology. I mean, you talked about how the, you know, it might, instead of future farmers of America, they might be microbiologists. I mean, it's we still need those jobs, and people can be trained in technology, and I don't think we're doing a very good job of that.
Yes, absolutely. So that's been the trend in a lot of the American workforce for a long time, is towards specialization. And you know, the number of farmers in America has precipitously declined over the last century, to the point where now only 1% of Americans have any real relationship with commercial farming at all. And that number is likely to continue to go down as we continue having more and more efficient ways of producing food for us.
I remember seeing a video quite a few years ago of Gene Bauer, who co-founded Farm Sanctuary, and I remember him walking through an old slaughterhouse and that had been closed down. And one of the things that was so beautiful about it that really moved me to tears was seeing all of the cracks in the concrete part ways for nature to take over, because it hadn't been used, because it wasn't being used the way it, you know, as a slaughterhouse. And I just saw life kind of taking over what had been dominated by death and killing. And I want to believe so badly, Paul, I want to believe that as we move toward a future where we can envision slaughter-free agriculture, meat, slaughter-free animal agriculture, right? Just this idea that we can move away from animal agriculture. I want to believe that all of the areas in our world that have been decimated and degraded for ranching, for grazing, you know, all of it, I want to believe that it will come back to nature. But that seems like that would be its own feat and fight in itself, that people who've been privately owning this land would just turn it back over to nature. We have this vision that, right, we can end animal agriculture and, you know, reforest the world. Do you share that? Do you share that vision? Is that something we could look to?
I think it's more realistic than you do, I think, to be honest. I mean, the question is, what else would these lands be used for? And in some cases, maybe they get developed. But in other cases, I think you could see, for example, a farm bill that includes the type of conservation credits that allow farmers to reforest their land and get conservation credit for them. So they're incentivized economically to have that reforestation. So I'm not so sure that that is that unrealistic, that at least some land that is currently used for agriculture will be returned to areas where wildlife can start eking out an existence again.
Okay, I'm gonna hold that. And on that note, then, so those who have been making a living off of the land and off of animals, so what has the meat industry, how have they been reacting to clean meat? We know from my last episode how they've been reacting to plant-based meats. How are they reacting to this clean meat revolution?
It's varying. So you talked about the difference between Kodak and Canon, which is absolutely accurate. And there are companies like Cargill that are actively investing in clean meat companies like Memphis Meats. Tyson Foods, which is the biggest meat producer, has not yet invested in clean meat, though they have made a pretty substantial investment into plant-based meat with two rounds of investing into Beyond Meat. Now we see Maple Leaf Foods, the biggest meat producer in Canada, investing in and owning now Field Roast and Light Life. So there is a shift that's happening among big meat producers to start dipping their toe in the plant-based and clean meat worlds. But so far, you haven't seen any real big breakthrough in terms of a meat producer saying, hey, we're going to start producing this. The big dream of many of these companies like Hampton Creek and Mosa Meat, which is a company in the Netherlands, is not to become clean meat sellers themselves, but rather to license their clean meat technology to the big meat producers for them to produce it on their own. That hasn't happened yet, but I don't think it's unrealistic that it would happen. I think that there's a lot of interest in meat industry executives, both who I've spoken with and who I've heard about, in doing something like that.
Again, the stories you tell in the book just really characterize how quickly this is moving and how real it is, so that people are really seeing it as not only a threat, but as something to really invest in themselves.
Yeah, that's the goal. I mean, we want the meat industry to shift to these products. So hopefully it doesn't, hopefully to the extent that it's perceived as a threat, it's also perceived as an opportunity for them.
So you talk in the book about the obstacles. One I just want to ask about has to do with the consumer perception of these things. Of course, people have asked me about my thoughts about it and the reality of the healthfulness, if you will, of the meats, because of course it's still animal flesh, and as we talk about, we know animal flesh has, you know, dietary cholesterol and saturated fat. So can you talk about it from a perspective? I know Valetti, the cardiologist, the founder of Memphis Meats, talks about how he wants these products to be better not only for the animals and the earth, but also for people. So what's the difference between flesh from the cellular agriculture and flesh from a living animal? What's the difference in terms of heart health?
Sure. Well, first and foremost, there is clearly the benefit on food safety. However, on the other issues, it's expected that clean meat will have the same nutritional qualities as conventional meat. So if to the extent that there are heart problems, then they probably would be associated with those clean meats too. There's a lot of talk, though, from people like Dr. Valetti, the CEO of Memphis Meats, who, as you noted, is a cardiologist, about trying to create meat that is not only better for animals on the planet, but also better for the consumer. And so theoretically, you could envision having a meat that instead of having saturated fat would have omega-3 fatty acids. And then theoretically, you could have a hamburger that, rather than producing heart attacks, actually prevents them. However, it's not as easy as it sounds, because saturated fat has an important mouthfeel that is critical to the way that meat tastes. So right now, the goal is simply to create meat that is pretty much the same except safer than the meat that we have today. But the long-term goals are to also make it healthier. I will make one observation on this. So again, you know, clean meat is not necessarily for vegans or vegetarians. But when I hear my vegan or vegetarian friends complaining on this point, saying, well, you know, I wouldn't eat it because it's still bad for you. You know, I have a lot of vegan friends on social media, and my feed is routinely filled with celebratory posts about the latest and greatest vegan donuts and vegan cheese pizza and vegan cheese fries. And I have a feeling that these people are not considering the healthful aspects of these foods, or lack thereof, when they're celebrating them. And indeed, I celebrate them myself, too. So, you know, for me, I choose to be vegan because I think it is an ethical way to live, but I still eat foods that are unhealthy from time to time, whether they be vegan donuts or French fries or whatever. And so I'm not so sure that argument is really that compelling for most people.
Yeah, I agree. I have a very good friend, Anne Dunn. She's the founder of Cat Town, and one of her mottos is better is better. Like it's so simple. It's like, yeah, better is better. It's better.
I like it.
And there's a spectrum. So what are a couple of other obstacles? And just because, of course, I'm always thinking from an advocacy perspective, and so are many of my listeners, what are some of the obstacles, and what are some ways we as advocates for animals can maybe talk about clean meat in a way that, again, just really furthers conversation, that doesn't further the ick factor that people may have as a knee-jerk reaction? So how can we talk about it to kind of get over some of these obstacles publicly in the consumer public realm?
Great question. So the first thing is, you know, you don't want to lead by talking about the ick factor. I think that, you know, some people want to use terms, especially in the media, like lab-grown meat or test tube meat, or even worse sometimes. And we should avoid doing that. You only get one chance to make a first impression. Mm-hmm. And what you call it really matters. Nobody has hit this point harder than you, Colleen, and I think correctly so. What we call foods really matters, and it shapes the way that we think about it. And so the number one thing, I think, is to use terms like clean meat. But I also think just celebrating these companies, when you see it in the news, posting things online, celebrating these companies is a very good way of helping get these this discussion started off on the right foot. So I think, you know, needless to say, buying the book Clean Meat for all, every family member and friend, preferably, it's better the second time, but you should read a different copy, so you might want to buy two for yourself. But, I mean, seriously, the real key, I think, is to talk about it in terms of the promise that it holds. And then when people ask, oh, isn't that unnatural, which is inevitably what people bring up, it gives us a chance to talk about how unnatural the current method of meat production is. What I ask people when they bring this up is I say, listen, just consider the life of the chicken who was raised for your chicken salad as an example. You know, she was genetically selected to grow so big, so fast that she couldn't take more than a few pitiful steps before collapsing. She lived in her own feces, never saw sunlight, never stepped foot on a blade of grass. I was pumped full of antibiotics, and when it came time for her slaughter, you probably don't want to know about it yourself. Mm-hmm. So when you think about how unnatural and inhumane our current method of meat production is, all of a sudden, clean meat starts seeming like the naturally preferable option. And so I think by using terms like clean meat and talking about how unnatural our current and present method of meat production is, that it helps these companies get off in the right step, in the right direction. There is another thing I would recommend, which is that if you or somebody you know is in the venture capital world, or if you or somebody you know is thinking about starting a company, or you're thinking about what you want to study in school, for example, in order to help animals, there's lots of ways to help animals. Some people will say, I want to be as good of a communicator as Colleen, so I'm going to get a degree in communications. Or they may think, I want to go to law school so I can become a great lobbyist for animals. Those are cool. But if you like science and you're good at it, why not thinking about studying stem cell biology or tissue engineering or other ways that you could be the next Henry Ford? Being Henry Berg is great. There's no shame in it. I am a big admirer of his. But you could be the next Henry Ford or maybe the next Uma Valetti from Memphis Meats. You just don't know. And so I would think about what in terms of your own career you're doing to help animals and what options you have in that regard too.
I love that. And I appreciate that. And I really was impressed by how diversified the space is becoming so quickly, not only people who are becoming the microbiologists, but also just supporting people in doing so and funding the research and documenting the ingredients and like the Good Food Institute supporting it. I was really impressed how quickly it diversified in terms of the room for everyone to get involved in this. And if there is a hero in this book, everyone's a hero in this book. I really appreciated the stories. I think stories are very powerful, and you told the stories so well of the people in this space. But I really have to say, I kind of fell in love a little bit with Dr. Valetti. I just really, he just seems so incredible and so sensitive and kind and brilliant, and was just really impressed. And I loved his synthesizing of it, no pun intended, not dissimilar from Churchill's, but the idea, in this day and age, do we still need to grow a whole organism to break it down into little pieces for the simple tissue that we like to eat? That did synthesize it for me, because I really love the idea of talking about it and framing it in a way of building something up rather than breaking something down, just creating something rather than destroying something. And I just really love that way of talking about it. It really helped me kind of frame it in my head.
Yeah, that's cool. That's really great. And I totally agree with your assessment of Uma Valetti. And I also agree with your assessment of the Good Food Institute, which is a nonprofit organization dedicated to helping these companies, not only creating them and investing in them through their venture capital arm, which is called New Crop Capital, but also through helping them. You know, a lot of startups, they don't have the means to have their own advertising or marketing or PR firms, and the Good Food Institute essentially acts as that that force for them in terms of helping them create their websites, draft their press releases, and et cetera, and their, you know, all websites, everything. So this book is about people. I mean, it's a book that is really just intended to tell the story of the entrepreneurs, the investors, the nonprofit organizations that are collectively devoted to trying to solve this huge problem of factory farming. And they collectively have created a solution that has enormous potential to address many of humanity's most pressing problems. But these people are just people. They aren't different from you and me. In fact, many of them come from the same circle that we do. Mm-hmm. Many of them are just vegan animal advocates, or they've been working in the environmental movement, who decided that actually food technology is the most promising way to solve this problem. And so they've left their work in animal advocacy to become part of this new clean meat movement.
And they're still advocates. It's just in a different way than we would characterize them. They are advocating.
Yes. Yeah. By animal advocacy, I mean they aren't out there doing the type of things that you and I are doing.
Sure. My favorite, though, takeaway, and I will leave everyone with this thought, because I think, again, distilling the way to talk about this, I know this was you, and you're just going to have to take credit for it because it's brilliant, is the potential future conversation, although present conversation too, especially in terms of our conversation around the word meat, is you say that perhaps the future motto for clean meat, but I still think it applies today, is eat meat, not animals.
I'm proud to say that I'm pretty sure that I did come up with that, but yes. Yes, I love that idea. Eat meat, not animals.
Oh,
that may seem like an impossibility in today's world, but in the future, in the near future, probably years, not decades, that could be a reality.
And meat, considering the fact that plant-based meats are such, we can get away from fake meat, as we even as vegans and vegetarians will call it, getting away from that. That's also meat. So eat meat, not animals, and read Clean Meat, everyone. Paul, when is the book officially coming out?
January 2nd, although there are pre-orders available. So you can go to cleanmeat.com. And you can see a whole variety of ways, from Amazon to Barnes & Noble to iBooks and more, where you can pre-order it to make sure you get it on January 2nd rather than having to order it then.
And January 2nd, 2018, we're talking about. But of course, if you're listening to this afterwards, you're already aware of it because it's a bestseller and yes. It's a household name. And you are going to put this on the tips of everyone's tongues. And I am just so, so grateful to you for writing this book and telling these stories. And I probably know the answer to this, but you know I like to end with asking you, what gives you hope, Paul?
There are so many things that offer hope for animals. Certainly, I think that clean meat is one of them. But because that's such an obvious answer for this podcast, I will offer something else, which is that right now we're seeing a shift in our culture. I see it every day of my life, where people are beginning to recognize that the animals of this planet don't exist merely for us, but rather are living here with us. And I see that shift every day when I'm talking to people, when I'm talking to journalists, when I'm talking to people on the street. And I really think that we are in the midst of a cultural revolution when it comes to our relationship with other animals. And the existence of these clean meat companies can help accelerate that in a way that really hasn't been done before. So, for example, when you're no longer dependent on whales for oil because you have kerosene, you can all of a sudden have a much more compassionate view of whales. Mm-hmm. When we don't need horses to transport us around anymore, we can have a much more humane attitude toward horses. The same is so with farm animals, and I think that it's already happening in terms of our societal shift in perspective. And the proliferation of both plant-based meats and clean meats will help accelerate it.
Well, Paul, you give me hope. And everyone whose story you tell in Clean Meat gives me hope. And I'm grateful for that. And thanks for giving that hope to all of my listeners.
I'm grateful to you, Colleen. Thank you very much. As you know, I'm a fan. And I am really honored that you took the time to read the book and that you found it so useful. Thank you.
Well, thanks for listening, everybody. I welcome your comments. You can, of course, comment on the page for today's episode at joyfulvegan.com. I'd love to hear what you think. Thank you again for listening, for subscribing, and of course, for supporting, which you can do at joyfulvegan.com. Just click on the donate button for the animals. This is Colleen Patrick-Gaudreau. Thanks for listening.